Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio231. It is December 1st, and it's a Monday. We're going to look at the schedule in just a second, but I keep forgetting about this, and I don't want you guys to forget about it. The deadline for your online assignment for last week is tonight. It was not on Thanksgiving night. All right, so if you didn't complete that week, make sure you get into Blackboard and finish that up, right, the assignment. And the one for this coming Thursday is still this coming Thursday, so don't get caught off guard by that, okay? Does anybody still have to do their assignment for last week tonight? Anybody still have to do it tonight? Yeah, don't forget about it. Write it down on your hand or something so you don't forget to do that. Okay. Yes. Questions? Oh, yeah. I think it's worth, all of them are worth 5 points. But the instructions say 7.5. Yeah, the instructions I think are wrong. But I can double-check on that. Yeah. Do we have any announcements from SI? No? Okay. Any questions last time? Last time we talked about respiratory system. All right, so we're going to move on to digestive system. Well, actually, let's look at the schedule first. Okay, so today's the first. Digestive system, Wednesday, we'll talk about urinary. Then a week from today, we're going to talk about diversification system, and that's it for lab. Next week, we also have practicums. We'll have practicums on Monday and also a quiz after that for the Monday group. Wednesday group, you're going to have a practicum, no quiz, but a lecture exam same day. All right, and it's 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25 on that last test, which is pretty much what the last practicum covers as well. Okay, anybody got a question on the schedule? Don't forget, for that last lecture exam, you need a nice clean Scantron, pencil, a really good eraser, and your picture ID. All right, so please don't screw around with that picture ID because I can't release the results of the test, and I'm not going to be around. All right, and I won't even be around to file an incomplete, so that probably means I got to give you a letter grade with a zero for that exam. So don't forget your picture ID. And it's a real hassle filling in a grade change because that triggers an audit over there in admissions administration and records, and so I won't do that unless there's a real reason why. Right? A real reason why would not be because you forgot your picture ID someplace, right? So make sure you have your picture ID so we can close off the test. And then Wednesday after the test and after lab, you still have a deadline on Thursday after that for the last online work. All right, so the class really doesn't stop until Thursday. All right, I think that's all that I need to say about just some administrative stuff. All right, digestive system. We really take the digestive system for granted, especially after we survived last week and over the weekend, which was, what, Thanksgiving. And if your digestive system misbehaves for some reason, you'll really understand what the function is and how miserable it can make your life. So let's look at some of the components and how the intestines are supposed to function, and maybe a little bit about how what happens when they don't function properly. All right, so here is a picture of the digestive tract, starting with the oral cavity, right? It's a tube that runs through your body, right? Oral cavity, esophagus, stomach, and then we have small intestine, a couple of divisions of the small intestine, large intestine, a couple of divisions of the large intestine, anal canal, and anus. All right, so the digestive tract is not really, or stuff that's inside the digestive tract is not really inside your body, right? It's not like something that's in your circulatory system, in your blood. What's ever in your blood really is inside your body because it can freely exchange with tissues that you have, cells inside your body, but not so for the material that's in your digestive tract. It's just moving its way through that tube that runs through the center of your body. Okay, so those are the components of the digestive tract. There are some accessory structures that are associated with the digestive tract. And so we have salivary glands, right? We have teeth, we have liver, gallbladder, pancreas, and some other accessory structures that are involved with digestion and absorption. Okay, So I think I covered all the components. Well, a good place to start is with the layers of the digestive tract, and we have a nice model in lab that shows all four of the layers and some of the components of those four layers. So let's start here by looking at some of the layers. And layers are very important because that's how we understand disease. What kind of, which of the layers are involved with a disease process? So it's important for diagnosing, it's important for staging a disease process, right? And if you know what it is and you can stage it, then you can come up with a treatment. But if you can't identify it, can't stage it, then you're really at a loss as to what kind of treatment is necessary, which will eventually help your patients out. All right, so here are the four layers. Mucosa, that's the deepest layer. Then we have submucosa underneath it. The mucosa, deepest layer, this is the layer that's lining the tube on the inside. You could almost think of it as the endothelium of a blood vessel, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. All right, then deep to that is the submucosa. Deep to that is the muscularis. And then covering everything is the serosa. All right, so let's look at these on this picture in reverse order. So on the outside is the serosa, and that's basically just connective tissue. There is part of the peritoneum that surrounds the serosa, and that makes the intestines able to move around inside our abdominal cavity, because all these muscles make the intestines move around, but they're also important for digestion. All right, so after the serosa, then we have the muscularis externa, and on this section right here, I see two layers. I see one layer, and the cells are arranged longitudinal to the length of the tube. They're arranged in the order that the tube is moving. And then there's a circular layer, right? And so these form around the tube. So the longitudinal can make the tube shorter. The circular layer can actually pinch off one segment of the intestine from the other, right? It can almost become and can almost form like a sphincter or a valve or a gate between different neighboring sections of the small intestine and large intestine. All right, so then after the muscularis externa, right, we have the submucosa. And submucosa is loose connective tissue. It contains glands for secreting digestive materials and enzymes into the tube, the center, the lumen of the tube. And I think that's probably pretty good, right? The innermost layer, right, is the mucosa. And the mucosa has three main areas. Again, there's some smooth muscle. And notice, what is this arrangement of the smooth muscle? Can you see well enough on the slide? Is it circular or longitudinal? Yeah, see, so just like the superficial layer in the muscularis, right, it's a longitudinal layer. Then we have lamina propria. Lamina propria is connective tissue, but it can also contain some glands. And it can also contain a lot of immune response cells, right? MALT, right? Mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. And this is really important because the lumen of our digestive tract really is really outside of our body and is usually loaded with bacteria. And it's loaded with bacteria, but it's a good kind of bacteria that actually provides some benefit for us, can help provide vitamins. And we'll take a look at that in a little bit. But we shouldn't have bacteria that can invade our body. And so it's that lymphoid tissue that can selectively control different kinds of bacteria so that the good kind live in your digestive tract and that the bad kind don't live there. And if they're not there, then they can't invade the rest of your body. All right, and then we have, right, the epithelium. Right, you can consider this again like the endothelium, and that endothelium, right, is a stratified squamous in some parts of the digestive tract, or maybe it's a simple columnar in other parts. So if it's stratified squamous, that is a barrier to prevent movement of material from the lumen of that tube into your body, but it's also therefore abrasion. Because parts of your digestive tract are really rough. Maybe they contain acids, maybe they contain alkali or very strong bases, and material is moving around through them all the time. So remember, stratified squamous epithelium, the layer that's up against the lumen of the tube can scrape off, but it's replaced by the underlying layers very easily. The columnar epithelium is there because columnar cells are a little bit bigger. They have more cytoplasm, so they can do more things. They can, right, yeah, they're there for secretion and absorption. They have different kinds of enzymes. They're much bigger factories, so these cells are bigger than just a squamous type of cell. All right, so do you see the three layers? The mucosa, the submucosa, the muscularis externa, and the serosa, four layers. Now, there are some other things that I notice. All of these little yellow lines right here, these are nerves. And it's part of the myenteric nerve plexus, or enteric nervous system. And you have more nerves in your digestive tract than you do in your spinal cord. So that might be amazing. All right, so your spinal cord has a lot of nerves, but there are even more in your digestive tract, and that controls the activity of your digestive tract in terms of motion and secretion of digestive enzymes. As a matter of fact, people thought for many years that your brain was actually part of your digestive tract because there are so many nerves right there. But we know today that your digestive tract, right, or your myenteric nervous system is not really your brain or your spinal cord, right? That's certainly in your cranium and vertebral column. Okay. But I could see why people got mixed up with that a little bit. Parasympathetic and sympathetic are parts of divisions of the autonomic nervous system. And usually you think of sympathetic as being excitatory and parasympathetic as being inhibitory, like for instance on the heart, but that's not so for the digestive tract. Right, so if you think of the ways of categorizing parasympathetic and sympathetic, what would we characterize the sympathetic nervous system? Fight or flight, that's right, fight or flight. And what about parasympathetic? Right, yes, rest and digest, right? So the digest part, right, tells us that the parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory, is not inhibitory on digestive processes, including secretions and movement of the digestive tract. And if we think about movement of the digestive tract, we call that motility, right? Motility of the digestive tract, because that's going to move digesting materials down the tube, or maybe it might mix certain components together. All right, so those are the layers. All right, so let's look at that motility, which is controlled by some of the nerves, but also by some hormones. We got two kinds of motion within the digestive tract. We have peristalsis and segmentation. Peristalsis is the propulsion of material from one part of the digestive tract to the other, from a proximal part of the digestive to a distal part, right? So things are just going to be moving in one direction. We call that antrograde. It doesn't ever go backwards. So what does antrograde look like? Here is antrograde. All right, so from mouth to anus, this is peristalsis. So here is a bolus of digesting material, and we can see that it was close to the mouth, and it moves down into the stomach, small intestine, large intestine, and then down out of your body. And that's primarily due to the circular smooth muscle when it contracts, right? And so these things can't contract in a random fashion. They have to be coordinated, like it has to contract here, and then here, and then here, and then here, and that pushes the food down. But if it contracted here and then here, right, then this bolus of food would just move back and forth. It wouldn't move through the digestive tract. The second kind of motility is what we call segmentation. Right? And segmentation is a way of mixing. So peristalsis is a way of moving something in an antrograde fashion. Segmentation is mixing different components or different compartments of the intestine together. So let's take a look at that. We got three different cases right here of the same part of the intestine, and probably a good place to think about is maybe stomach. Stomach is really good at doing this kind of thing. All right, so here we have one kind of material in the superficial region, another kind of material in the middle region, and then even another kind down here in this distal region. Well, in order for digestion and absorption to take place efficiently, all of these materials should be mixed together. because there might be special enzymes down over here which aren't contained here, and they should be over here. All right, so what happens is that the circular smooth muscles will change position. Right, so here the circular smooth muscles are contracting and we see three separate segments. Then these segments relax, and at the center of the initial segments, the smooth muscle contracts once again. Right, so now we see a constriction here, and that chops this volume into two separate pieces, and it mixes one with this middle compartment. And so now we see a mixture of those two previous compartments together here, and in this chamber right over here as well, the superior one. Right, so now these compartments have been mixed together. Well, it doesn't stop right there. It keeps going, maybe back to this original position, right, and it just churns and churns and churns until eventually each one of these compartments have just a uniform concentration of enzymes and food and water, right? And so there's no variability in these different compartments. That's what segmentation is. So if you want to think of just one word for segmentation, a special kind of motility, what would you say? Segmentation is for mixing. Yeah, mixing. And that's really an important function of the stomach. Okay. All right, let's follow some food as it moves through your digestive tract. Well, in your oral cavity, there are salivary glands. We looked at those in lab, and they secrete saliva. Some of the salivary glands secrete an enzyme in that saliva called amylase. Amylase can digest starch, and starch is a big complex molecule made out of a simple sugar called glucose. And in order for your body to absorb sugar, it has to be in the form of glucose, or maybe, and that's what we call a monosaccharide. Maybe there are times it can absorb disaccharides, but certainly it can't absorb starch, which has thousands and thousands of molecules of glucose. All right, so the initial digestion of starches takes place in the mouth, and during a typical 24-hour period, we produce about 1.5 liters of fluid, of saliva. So if you were to walk around all day long and never swallow and just spit into a container, right, it would be not quite 2 liters, right, but for sure 1 liter and probably a little bit more. Who's got a 1 liter container? What's that right there? Is that about a liter? No? Right there, what's that bottle say? Yeah, what does that bottle say right there? 700? 8 ounces? 20 ounces, yeah, I don't know what that is in terms of liters, milliliters. Maybe it says 500? Half a liter, 500 mLs. Okay, so the amount of saliva that we secrete is 3 of those things every day. And you don't have to prove it to yourself unless you're really interested, okay? You can just take me at my word, right? 3 of those containers. All right, and then another function of saliva is that it acts as a lubricant, and so there is a bolus of food in your oral cavity, and it can make its way into the esophagus, and the esophagus, then that bolus is moved by, what kind of motion propels food from your oral cavity down into your stomach? So here's the esophagus. It is, yeah, your choice would be peristalsis or segmentation, and of course you would want to say peristalsis, right? Okay, so the first third of the esophagus right here is skeletal muscle. That's what you have voluntary control of, right? But the inferior two parts, or the distal two-thirds of the esophagus, are smooth muscle. So once you swallow something, right, and it gets into this middle segment right here, there's nothing you can do to prevent that material from entering the stomach, because it's just automatically controlled by the smooth muscle and the enteric nervous system that is there. Right, so it moves into the stomach. Sometimes some people have an irritation of the esophagus and food gets trapped in the esophagus, that peristalsis is disturbed for one reason, so food moves down really close to the stomach but doesn't quite get in there, and then there's like a reverse peristalsis that brings it up toward the oral cavity. And then when it gets in this region up over here, then the normal peristalsis takes over and it shoves it back down to the stomach, but again, it doesn't quite reach the stomach. It gets pushed back up toward the mouth, and that bolus of food can like oscillate, can move around from close to your stomach back up to the oral cavity a number of times. It's not really dangerous, but it sounds really funny when that happens. And the person is really uncomfortable, of course, when that happens. Okay. The esophagus, there's a big difference between the esophagus and the trachea. All right, so we're going to go back to the previous chapter. What organ system does a trachea belong to? What system? Yeah, respiratory system. And what's noteworthy about the trachea? It has some special things. What's a special thing that it has? That has cartilaginous rings, that's right. And what do those cartilaginous rings do? Why are they there? It prevents collapse of the trachea so that we can move air out of our lungs. Your trachea is held open all the time so that when we compress our chest, we can exhale. If that cartilage wasn't there, when we compress our chest, the trachea would occlude and air would be trapped in our lungs. And that would make you feel really miserable because if you can't get rid of old air, you can't get new air in. Right, and so you're going to feel like you're choking to death. So that cartilage is really important. But what's the downside for having that cartilage in your trachea? It holds the trachea open all the time. What is one serious thing that can happen because the trachea is held open all the time? I think I heard it. Yeah, you can choke, right? You can. All you have to do is get something over the larynx, over the glottis, and let go, and that material is going to drop right into the trachea, and then you can't. Then you lose that air passageway, right? And again, you're really uncomfortable when that happens. Well, you don't have to worry about that with the esophagus. It's just a muscle tube, and a muscular tube doesn't have cartilage holding it open, so the esophagus is closed all the time, unless you're swallowing something. All right, so what does that esophagus look like when it's closed? Might I have a picture of the esophagus? I guess I don't have a picture of the esophagus when it's closed. Do I? I don't. Well, let's just look here. And we're too low. We can't see the esophagus. All right, so let's go back here. All right, so the esophagus is closed all the time. So the inner walls of the esophagus are touching each other. The right side is touching the left, the anterior side is touching the posterior side because it shrinks down. Can you have a picture of that in your mind? How all the interior sides of the esophagus are touching? And that has some really important clinical ramifications. Things can't fall into the esophagus, right, and then into the stomach, but, right, when the esophagus can be damaged, how could you damage an esophagus? How could you damage an esophagus? A couple of different ways. What's one way that you could think of where somebody could damage their esophagus? Swallow something sharp, yeah, like maybe glass or something will lacerate, right, the esophagus. How about if somebody stored some gasoline in a Coke bottle in your garage or where you park your car? And I come over for Thanksgiving dinner and I see this Coke bottle right there and I go, oh, right, Coke bottle. And I drink what I think is Coke, but it's really gasoline, right? That's going to burn the esophagus, right, all the way down to the stomach. Or maybe some little kid is going to pick up some drain cleaner. And what does drain cleaner smell like? Kind of minty, right? Kind of has like a little candy kind of smell to it. And if somebody eats that drain cleaner, that's going to burn the esophagus again. Okay, so that kind of trauma to the esophagus, that burning of the esophagus is going to cause scar tissue to develop, and no one has ever figured out a way how to have the esophagus heal and grow back so that it's an open tube. That scar tissue always grows back, and it blocks the material from going from the oral cavity into the stomach, right? Because it just forms the scar tissue, and the walls of the esophagus are touching each other, so these things get like sewed together. All right, so that is a serious problem because somebody won't ever be able to eat again. So what do you think about storing chemicals in a Coke bottle around your house or in any kind of bottle that's mislabeled? You got to be really careful about that, right? To make sure that you keep these harmful chemicals away from little kids that might want to experiment, right? Keep soda pop bottles away from me if I come over so I don't drink something, right? Because I don't ever want to give my esophagus away. Another way to damage the esophagus, kind of akin to maybe eating something really sharp, is that when you have surgery sometimes, they have to put an endotracheal tube into your trachea, right? And if they miss and put the endotracheal tube into the esophagus, sometimes that can rip the esophagus as well. All right, so that's for anesthesia purposes. So if you're ever undergoing anesthesia, inhalation anesthesia, talk to your anesthesiologist and make sure they've done it before on somebody. Make sure you're not the first person, okay? Because then you might have problems swallowing or completely not be able to swallow after that. Because that endotracheal tube belongs where? In the trachea, not the esophagus. And where's the trachea with respect to this esophagus right here? Yeah, it's anterior, right? So it's not on this illustration. It's not behind, but it's anterior, about in this region here. Okay, so there's some different problems you can run into, whether the tube is open all the time or if it's closed all the time. All right, well, the esophagus doesn't secrete anything into the food, okay, that you're swallowing. So then that food moves into the stomach, and you might automatically think, well, part of your digestive tract, part of the stomach is for digesting and absorbing nutrients. And that's really one of the last things that the stomach is known for. Right? The stomach is mostly known for storing and mixing. You could say storing and what kind of motion? Segmentation. That's right, mixing. All right, so what kind of motility is mixing? Well, you just told me. I just asked you in a different way. There is some initial protein digestion that takes place with an enzyme called pepsin, and pepsin can denature proteins if it's in a highly acidic environment. So your stomach also secretes hydrochloric acid, and that activates this pepsin, which is that enzyme that can denature proteins. But there is really no absorption whatsoever. A little bit of digestion due to pepsin, but no absorption of lipids, no absorption of proteins or amino acids, no absorption of any kind of sugar molecules. All right, so storing and mixing. There is something that's really important that the stomach secretes into the stomach, and it's called intrinsic factor. Right, intrinsic factor is a necessary compound, right, for absorption of vitamin B12. That absorption doesn't take place in the stomach, takes place in the small intestine, but without intrinsic factor, vitamin B12 can't be absorbed. And vitamin B12 has another name, sometimes it's called cobalamin. It has a little atom of cobalt in it. You don't need a whole lot of this mineral. You need a little bit so that you can absorb vitamin, what is the function of vitamin B12 or cobalamin? It helps regulate DNA synthesis, right? So it helps regulate mitosis. And that's a very important process. Without being able to regenerate tissues, there's no way for you to stay alive. Right? So if somebody is missing their stomach completely, then eventually they're going to pass away because they don't have vitamin B12 in their diet. So then they need what? They need some exogenous vitamin B12 so that those processes can continue because they don't produce that intrinsic factor. So that's pretty important. I forgot a good dietary source of vitamin B12. Maybe it will come to me in just a second. All right, so when food is in the stomach and your stomach secretes intrinsic factor, hydrochloric acid, and pepsin, and it's mixed all together, that's what we call chyme. Right, all of these materials right here we call gastric juice. When gastric juice is mixed with food, we call that chyme. All right, so how much fluid then is secreted? Oh, about 1.5 liters of gastric juice every day. All right, so what's the total of fluid that we have lost in our body so far? How much saliva? Yeah, 1.5 liters. 1.5 liters of gastric juice, so 3 liters. So right now, we're dehydrated by 3 liters because remember, what about all that material in your digestive tract? Is it inside your body or is it really outside your body? It's really outside your body, right? So you're losing that amount of fluid just by getting things into your stomach. All right, so what can we know about the stomach? What kind of cells? Well, there are goblet cells. Guess what a goblet cell does? It secretes mucus. Mucus is part protein and part sugar, and it's very insensitive to acid. Acid really has no effect on it. So hydrochloric acid can't really dissolve, right, or digest that mucus. So mucus, when it's aligning on the stomach, prevents the stomach itself from being digested and from being etched down to nothing with hydrochloric acid. So those goblet cells are really important. There are also parietal cells that secrete hydrochloric acid and that intrinsic factor. There's another kind of cell called a chief cell. A chief cell secretes that precursor to pepsin, and it secretes pepsinogen. Right? If chief cells actually produce an active enzyme, pepsin, then that pepsin would digest the chief cells away, which would not be very good for you. Right? So chief cells produce pepsin in an inactive form, and then when it mixes with hydrochloric acid from the parietal cells in the lumen of the stomach, then it becomes an active pepsin molecule. And the chief cells also produce gastric lipase. What's the substrate for gastric lipase? What can it break down? Yeah, lipids, fat. So it helps break the fats down. Okay. Well, when I look at pepsinogen, okay, I know it's inactive just because of the form of the word, the shape of the word, right? Whenever you see an ogen as a suffix on a word, that means that's inactive. But it can be converted into an active form very rapidly, maybe by clipping off a little piece of that enzyme, or maybe changing its conformation a little bit. All right, so pepsinogen is inactive, but it can be converted into an active form right away. As an example, there's another word that's very important for blood clotting, and it's called fibrinogen. What can you tell me about fibrinogen? Is it active? It's inactive because it has that ogen at the end of the word, but it can be activated by clotting factors in your body very rapidly. Right? So you don't want blood clotting as we're sitting right here, right? Because then our blood will stop flowing through our body. It's only when we damage a blood vessel, lacerate a blood vessel, or rip it open somehow, right? Then that fibrinogen is converted into fibrin that forms a blood clot, and it stops blood loss as a result of that. Okay, so ogen, inactive but ready to go to work. Well, since we have pepsin in the stomach and hydrochloric acid and even this gastric lipase, the lining of the stomach takes a big beating, even though it's covered with mucus. Right? And so these cells are replaced about every 6 days. The lining of your stomach every 3 to 6 days. There are undifferentiated stem cells that renew the gastric epithelium. Right, and I guess that makes sense. Right, if you have cells really close to all that hydrochloric acid, then they're not going to live for very long. All right, the small intestine. I tell you what, let's go back to the stomach. If you're going to think of the stomach, what are the two functions of the stomach? Storage and mixing. Okay. Now, the stomach is going to contract. So here is the stomach. Here is a sphincter. Anybody know what a sphincter is? What's a sphincter? Yeah, it's a circular muscle, but it's not a skeletal muscle. It's not like the orbicularis oculi, orbicularis oris, which is under voluntary control. This is smooth muscle, but nonetheless, it is circular, so it can open and close. It can allow for material to move from the stomach into the small intestine, or when it's contracted, it will prevent motion, right? And it pretty much listens to the small intestine. When the small intestine is ready to accept some more chyme for processing, then this pyloric sphincter opens up and the stomach contracts and it pushes some more stuff into the small intestine. But when the small intestine is busy doing its job, which is what? Digestion and absorption, right? If it's busy processing material, then this pyloric sphincter is closed because the small intestine can only work on so much material. Right, so here is that pyloric sphincter. And the only other difference, the stomach right here, compared to most divisions of the digestive tract, is that it has three layers of muscularis externa. I didn't have you guys look at this for the quiz, right, but sometimes I have this as a labeling quiz. Right, so here is that stomach, and here's that serosa. The layer just underneath the serosa is the muscularis externa, and you can see there is a circular layer, here's a longitudinal layer, and then here is an oblique layer. So the stomach is very strong, important for what? Segmentation. Here's that pyloric sphincter, and the other thing that you notice about the stomach, right, it has all of these folds. These folds are what we call rugae. And generally, what's the function of a fold? What does that do? Yeah, it makes something that's really big shrink down into something that's smaller, right? And so your stomach can get really, really big without ripping and perforating. And if we go back to this initial picture up over here, right? Urinary bladder is down in this region right over here. Notice that the stomach is way superior in this direction, right? If somebody eats and eats and eats, it is possible to have the stomach fill up with so much food that it distends all the way down to the urinary bladder because of those rugae, right? And what's the job of that stomach then? Just to hold on to all of that material, mix it up, right, until the small intestine is ready to process it. It can't process all of that, all right, eaten food or chyme that's in the stomach. And raise your hand if that happened to you on Thursday. Did that happen to anybody on Thursday? No, that's good, right? So you were calorie responsible. That's wonderful. Hopefully you were alcohol responsible too, okay? But calorie responsible is really important. All right, let's go back to the stomach. You got to know all of these structures on the stomach. Okay, here's that big, strong pyloric sphincter, and the stomach has some regions. The region that's the most superior part of the stomach, this is what we call the fundus or fundic region. The stomach produces gas sometimes, and it just accumulates in this region of the stomach because that's the most superior part. And then inferior to it and close to the esophagus is the cardiac region or cardia. All right, so a lot of students will mix this up, and I can't imagine why it happens, but on a test or a practicum, I'll have a lead line right here, and of course this is going to be erased, and I'll ask, what's the name of this region of the stomach? And this is really surprising. You know how most people label that? They say this is the cardiac region. But is this the cardiac region? No. What region is this? The superior part right here. This is the fundus or fundic region. Yeah. So I don't know, pay really close attention to that. Now if I ask this region down over here, then you can say cardiac region, right, or cardia. All right, if we compare the entrance of the esophagus to the stomach with the entrance, right, into the small intestine from the stomach, you see a difference. Do you see any kind of difference between this pyloric sphincter and this region right here, the entrance from the esophagus into the stomach? Do you see any difference at all? Which has more smooth muscle? Okay, so here's the cardiac region. Here is the pyloric sphincter. Can you see that there are many more circular smooth muscles in the pyloric sphincter than there is right here? As a matter of fact, I don't see any circular smooth muscles. And sometimes we call this the esophageal sphincter, and it's very weak. It's almost non-existent. So it's very easy for chyme, which is mixed with acid, to reflux, to go back up into the esophagus, and the esophagus doesn't have the goblet cells or protective cells. It gets damaged by that hydrochloric acid, right? And that causes a lot of pain for some people, and you might feel like you're having a heart attack, and that's why this area of the stomach is called the cardiac region, because people feel like they have cardiac symptoms when that happens. And that can be a really serious condition, because that acid can actually eat away at the esophagus and eat away at blood vessels, and you can have a hemorrhage, kind of a massive hemorrhage from the esophagus right here. Okay, and that's called esophageal reflux disease, gastroesophageal reflux disease. As a matter of fact, the sphincter is so weak, some people even have to sleep kind of sitting up to prevent that reflux from happening. All right, the reason why some people don't have it is because of the angle that the esophagus empties into the stomach. It comes down superiorly, and then it puts a little kink right here. Like if you were to bend a straw kind of abruptly, that puts a little kink in the straw. And that little bend right in the esophagus helps most people from getting that esophageal reflux. Okay, couple curvatures. Lesser curvature, greater curvature. From lab, what organ just kind of follows the greater curvature of the stomach? Yeah, the spleen. You have a picture of that nice, thin, smooth organ right on this greater curvature margin of the stomach. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it for what I wanted to say about the stomach. And then we're going to go into the small intestine. The environment of the stomach is acidic. The environment of the small intestine is very basic. All right, so there has to be material to neutralize all of that acid. It's called bicarbonate. And then it also makes the environment of the small intestine very basic. And the enzymes for breaking down proteins need that kind of environment, right? And that's no longer pepsin, that's called trypsin. Trypsin needs a very basic environment for it to work. Let's go back to that initial picture right here. All right, so here I see the pyloric sphincter. Then here is that proximal segment of the small intestine, which is what we call the duodenum. It's got a middle segment that we call the jejunum, and then the most distal segment, right before it empties into the large intestine, this is what we call the ileum. So the small intestine has these three different divisions. They're a little bit different. If you were just to show me a picture or a segment of the small intestine, I couldn't tell you which one is which. You'd have to be an expert and actually use a microscope to be able to tell what the difference is. Okay. So, it pretty much has the same kind of structure. Let's look at the structure of that small intestine in a little bit more detail. Okay, small intestine. All right, so here is a nice illustration of the small intestine. We can see the usual layers, right, like the serosa, muscularis, submucosa, and then even the mucosa lining. Right. Well, there are some things that you can see even without a microscope. If we look inside the lumen of this tube, is it flat and smooth? No. You see all these ridges, right? And sometimes we call these transverse ridges. Sometimes we call these circular folds. Okay. Sometimes we call these plicae circularis. It has a number of different names. So why do you think you have all of these folds in the small intestine? Almost like the same reason why you have all those folds on the surface of your brain. It enlarges the area for absorption. It enlarges the surface area. All right, so take this little segment of the small intestine, and what can you do to flatten out all of these circular folds? You can stretch it out. Okay, which tube is going to be longer, the one that's stretched out or the one that's all folded up? Yeah, the one that's stretched out is a lot longer, but if it's really long like that, it won't fit in your abdominal cavity. All right, so this is just the way that you can take this huge, long tube, right, fold it up so that it fits into a much smaller space, but it still has that surface area for exchange. So when I say surface area, what's that one term that you should think of that kind of gives you an idea of what the function is? Surface area. We measured the surface area of this table, but what else did we measure the surface area of last time? Time before? Oh, I'm sure I did it. This door, right? So when you think of surface area, I want you to think of doorway for exchange, right? As the doorway gets bigger, what happens to exchange? It gets bigger. It's greater. It is enhanced, right? So as the doorway increases, so does the surface area increases and the rate of exchange increases as well. Oh, let me put that away. All right, so let's take a look at the surface area, right? You should be thinking of what? Doorway? The surface area is just the length of something by its width. And the surface area of the small intestine is huge for a number of reasons. The first reason are these circular folds. right, the plique circularis. And if we calculate all the other reasons in, right, we would see that the smooth intestine, or the small intestine, without all these folds, the surface area would be about 3.5 feet square. Right? But if we take into account all of these different folds in the small intestine, its surface area grows from 3 feet to 2,200 square feet, or 47 by 47 feet, which is 240 square meters. Are you impressed by that increase in surface area? That's huge. And why is that important? For absorption of nutrients. That's a huge doorway. But in real life, what is that? Well, that's the floor area of an average two-level house. That's the doorway for absorption of nutrients just from our small intestine. Well, and there, of course, there are capillaries in there that are important for absorption. So what are all of the things? What are the things? There are three things that are important. The first one, all of these folds that we can see with our naked eye, the plique circularis. And then if we look at all of these folds on the surface of a fold, does that look flat and smooth in this region right here? I see a bunch of bumps on it. And these bumps are due to very small finger-like projections, right? And if we look at it in cross-section, I can see these finger-like projections right here. Each one is called a villus. All of these are what we call villi. So if we look at the surface of the small intestine, it certainly doesn't look flat and smooth. It looks very velvety. With your naked eye, you can almost see what a villus looks like, but we don't really have a really good resolution to see an individual villus. But we can sure see that the surface of that small intestine looks like velvet, okay, because of all of these villi. So if we were going to extend, if we're going to pull the small intestine so that it's completely flat, we'd have to pull it to get rid of all these plique circularis and keep pulling it to do what? To flatten out all of these villi as well. Right? Keep pulling and pulling and pulling, so we first flatten out the circular folds and flatten out all of these villi. So now you get an appreciation how big that doorway is, or what the extensive nature of all these different folds are. All right, so that's two things, the plique circularis, the villi, and then there is another thing. All right, so here is a villus from that previous picture, so we zoomed way in, and we can see the submucosa, here is the mucosa, here's the lining, right, of the mucosa, and you can see it's, what kind, is this a stratified squamous epithelium, or what kind of epithelium does this look like? Yeah, it's a nice columnar, simple columnar epithelium, right, and if we look at the border, right, the apical surface of each one of these columnar cells, let's zoom into this region over here, look what it has. Is it a flat, smooth surface? No, it is not. It has all of these microvilli. These are really hard to see with a light microscope. Maybe we got a little impression the first couple of weeks when we used a microscope, but these are even smaller than cilia, right? So if we want to flatten out that small intestine so it's absolutely flat and smooth, we'd have to pull it to smooth out, to flatten those plique circularis. We'd have to keep pulling to flatten out all of these villi, but we couldn't stop there. What else would we have to do? Keep pulling to flatten out all of these microvilli. And so that's how we end up with what a huge surface area for exchange, because these microvilli increase the surface area of this apical surface for exchange. All right, if we look at this villus, I can see some nice columnar cells, but I can also see this one here. What does this one look like? What's this one right here at the top of the cursor? You see the cursor? Nice goblet cell, right? So there is mucus being secreted onto the surface of this villus, and that protects these cells from being digested as well. I see a nice vascular system. I see a nice artery and a vein that project up into the villus. And I also see a lymphatic vessel right in the very center. Here is that lymphatic vessel. So there are three kinds of vessels. There's arteries, veins, and this lymphatic vessel, it's called a lacteal. So these blood vessels are important for absorbing amino acids and sugars, but not any fats. Fats are not absorbed by the circulatory system. They're absorbed by this lacteal. So fats in our diet are absorbed by this lacteal. They're processed a little bit by the epithelium, And then the lacteal picks them up, processes them some more, and eventually, right, this lymphatic tissue or this lymph flows into the liver, and the liver does the final processing of that lipid material that's in our diet. Okay, so I forgot, what is that lipid material called? It kind of looks milky white. I forget what it's called. It's probably a good idea for you to know what it's called. I'll think of it in just a little bit. Okay, so here we see some cells. Here we see a little pit or a hole in the side of the stomach, right? And it's lined with different kinds of cells, the enteroendocrine cells that secrete hormones, which control the motility of the small intestine and maybe control the motility of the stomach and even of the gallbladder, right? And they also then can secrete digestive enzymes into the lumen of the stomach as well. And so these sometimes are called intestinal crypts or crypts of Lieberkuhn, right? And here we have that. Okay, crypts of Lieberkuhn, also known as intestinal glands. They contain goblet cells, secrete mucus. The hormones that are released are secretin and cholecystokinin. All right, so secretin is secreted, right, when acid hits the small intestine, when acid comes from the stomach, right? And when acid hits the small intestine tells the stomach to stop providing material for it because it's busy. And that signal is called secretin. So secretin slows the activity of the stomach so that the small intestine doesn't get overworked. Cholecystokinin is a hormone that goes to the gallbladder and causes the gallbladder to contract. Right? And when the gallbladder contracts, what happens? What's inside the gallbladder? Bile. That's right. And when it contracts, bile gets pushed into the cystic duct and then into the bile duct. And then where does it end up? Into the pancreatic duct and then into the small intestine. All right, so I think we have a pretty good illustration of it. All right, so cholecystokinin released from the small intestine, saying that, oh, I got some new food in here. Right, I need some product from the gallbladder, namely bile, goes through the cystic duct, through the bile duct, into the pancreatic, and then into the small intestine. And there's some little sphincters here as well, right, the hepatopancreatic sphincter. There's a minor and a major duct. We're only going to be interested in this major pancreatic duct. And what is the job of bile? I think maybe I talked about it in lab. Yeah, it acts like a detergent. It helps emulsify. It helps break down big globules of fat into smaller globules so that they can be absorbed by the cells that line the small intestine and then get into a lacteal. So without bile, we'll have a lot of difficulty digesting and absorbing lipids that are in our diet. Okay, so this gallbladder is just an accessory structure along with the pancreas. Well, you see this duct going from the pancreas into the small intestine? The pancreas is also an accessory structure, and it produces enzymes. And it also produces that bicarbonate that we were talking about to neutralize acid that comes from the stomach. And it's secreted into the pancreatic duct, then empties into the small intestine. So how would you describe that function of the pancreas to secrete digestive enzymes and bicarbonates into the small intestine? You know, two major classes of glands. Which one? Okay, tell me what the two classes of... You got endocrine and exocrine, right? When digestive enzymes enter the pancreatic duct, is that an endocrine function or an exocrine function? Yeah, exocrine. So the pancreas in that sense is working as an exocrine gland because it's secreting that product into the pancreatic duct that finds its way into the small intestine. The pancreas is also an important endocrine gland because, I can't remember if we talked about this, probably not. It secretes hormones. And in particular, one you're really familiar with, and that is insulin, right? Insulin is responsible for decreasing blood glucose. It also secretes another hormone called glucagon, which increases blood glucose. So what can you tell me about glucagon and insulin?
They're
What's the relationship between them? Yeah, they're antagonistic to each other. And because they work antagonistically, you should have very precise and balanced control of blood glucose in your body. It's only when the pancreas gets sick, stops producing insulin, it produces what kind of disease? Yeah, diabetes mellitus in particular, right? One kind of diabetes mellitus. There's another that's called type 1. Type 2 diabetes mellitus, the pancreas is secreting normal amounts of insulin, but your body no longer recognizes that insulin, right? And so that's called diabetes type 2, right? But that's the endocrine function of the pancreas. Small intestine also has MALT, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, to help fight infection. And there are stem cells in the small intestine that are highly proliferative. They replace the lining of the small intestine, again, every 3 to 6 days. And so there is a, when we say proliferation, what process is taking place? What process? We learned about it maybe second week in school. IPMAT, what's IPMAT stand for? Yeah, mitosis, right? Proliferation is when you have one cell and then you got two, right? And you got four, then you got 8, 16, right? So that's just a way of what regenerating tissue, right, from these stem cells. All right, Peyer's patches we find in the small intestine. These are germinal centers, right, that contain that mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, and that helps fight infection. All right, but I definitely want you to know, what are the three structures in the small intestine that increase the surface area for absorption? What are those three? Microvilli, I heard. Villi, I heard. And the plicae circulars, or the circular folds. Something that's not shown on this slide as well that I think I want to mention. Let's go back to small intestine someplace. Where was it? Small intestine here. Okay, all of these villi right here also have some smooth muscle in them. So let's zoom into a villus. It's not shown on this illustration, right? There's some smooth muscle that goes up into the villus. It contracts, and it makes the villi move around, right? So when you're cooking something at home in a pan and you got some fire or hot burner underneath the pan, what do you do so that material that's close to the bottom of the pan doesn't burn? Yeah, you stir it up, okay? And what that does, it allows that material that's in the pan to absorb more heat so that the layer that's closest to that fire doesn't burn. All right, so when you stir something, what you're really doing is you're making that pan a lot bigger so that heat gets distributed over a greater volume. All right, so when you stir something, you also increase the surface area of something. You make the pan bigger. All right, that's the same job of the smooth muscle in a villus. When it makes this villus move around, it stirs up the contents of the small intestine, and that's a functional way to make the surface area bigger. Right, it's like stirring in a pan. It just distributes material much more evenly, and that helps, right, the transfer or absorption of materials. All right, so next time you stir something, you should think of, oh, I'm just making the pan bigger. Right, things will heat up a lot faster, and nothing will get too hot, and heat transfer will happen sooner. All right, so let's see, we talked about the pancreas. Now, how much material is secreted into the small intestine? I think it's about a liter. 1.8 liters of intestinal juice gets secreted into the duodenum, like that bicarbonate solution that the enzymes are in. So now, how much fluid has your body lost in a day? Because remember, inside your intestine is not inside your body, that's outside. 1.5 saliva, 1.5 gastric juice, and now 1.8 intestinal juice. What's that? That's 3, 4, almost 5 liters of fluid that you have lost from your body. And you dehydrate very rapidly if you really lost that material. All right, well, that's going to take us to the large intestine. And the large intestine. Let's talk about the function first. All right, there's no digestion taking place. So in a sense, it's sort of like the stomach, right? But there is some absorption. Very important function of the large intestine to resorb water and salt absorption, right? And also maybe vitamin K is produced there by some bacteria, the normal microbiota in the large intestine. Now, why is it important for the large intestine to absorb this water? Because how much have you lost? Almost 5 liters every day, right? You couldn't live with losing that much fluid. So that's the job of the large intestine, is to take this very watery mixture from the small intestine and resorb that water or absorb that water out of it so that that material becomes a little bit more solid. And that material is what we call feces. Right, so the job of the large intestine is to produce feces. But you should really appreciate what that is, what is really happening there. Water is being taken from the lumen of that tube and put back in your body so you do not dehydrate. And in the process of doing that, okay, feces is produced. But there's no digestion taking place in the large intestine. You've got to be familiar with the structure of that large intestine. Okay, where's that structure, large intestine? In humans, it's a lot different than in these fetal pigs that we're looking at. All right, so what's the last segment of the small intestine called once again? I tell you what are the three in the right order? Duodenum, jejunum, and ileum is the last one, right? So the ileum empties into the large intestine. So here I can see the last bit of the ileum, and here is the first part of the large intestine. This is what we call the cecum, and there's another really strong circular smooth muscle here, which we call a sphincter. This is what we call the ileocecal valve, right? It's not a valve. It doesn't allow, it only allows motion. It's active, right? It's really smooth, circular, smooth muscle. It's not like a flap in the heart, for instance, or a lymphatic vessel or a vein. And then material is emptied into the cecum, and then it makes its way superiorly through the ascending and across the transverse, down the descending into the sigmoid colon. And what's happening as materials moving through the large intestine, just like we showed? What's happening? What's being produced? Water. Okay, water is being absorbed, I agree. Yeah, feces is being produced by absorbing water and salt out of that mixture. That's really important. Now, what would happen if the large intestine is not doing its job? If you lose all of that water, what's going to happen to somebody? Okay. So you're going to be dehydrated as a result, and your electrolyte imbalance, these salts, will take place. So the electrical properties of your body become very disturbed. Right? Control of your heart rate, for instance, is controlled by these electrical properties, and nerve function, for instance. Right? And you know of a condition when the large intestine is not doing its job. What's being produced if the large intestine isn't absorbing water? What do we call copious amounts of watery stool? That's diarrhea, right? Okay, so it's important for the large intestine to do its job. Otherwise, you have diarrhea. What are the consequences of diarrhea if you can't control it? Dehydration and electrolyte imbalance, right? All right, well, who's most susceptible to that? Well, usually it's always what? The young and the elderly, right? That's who's most susceptible to everything. But especially young people, neonates, right? When they drink water that's not purified. And probably more people on the planet die of diarrhea, right? Due to drinking impure water than any other cause, right? And it's usually what? Newborns as a result of that. They just die of diarrhea. Okay. When do we go to? 5 after? 10 after. Well, we're done. All right, but we're not done talking about the large intestine, because we got to talk about malabsorption syndrome. All right, diarrhea is due to an infection, all right, but there can be other causes that produce diarrhea. And I want to talk about those. All right, sinus sheet is going around. And we don't have a whole lot to talk about next time. We just got to talk about liver function and some remaining things about the large intestine.